Hello and welcome to episode 163 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, Chris Weston, Wendy Kendall and Tom Cheesewright.
Well, good evening, Matt, and it's been a very interesting week. We've had the Prime Minister on, we've had lots of things happening in technology. It's been almost non-stop since last time we spoke, and it's been 8 days, right? This is a day later than we normally record.
I know, and I've confused myself already with that because I can't cope with temporal shifting in that kind of way. One is a creature of habit, even more so when one spends every day in the same room. And so I've got no idea what day of the week it is. I just point out, though, we didn't have the Prime Minister on the show at any point. It made it, the way you described that, it was like that we'd invited that odious toe rag to... I'm not doing that. I'm sorry. I don't care even if he wants to come on. I'm not having
him. Are you saying that we wouldn't have that sweaty grifter on our podcast?
No, I don't think I could bring myself to it. I couldn't debase ourselves.
No,
you know, I mean, we've debased ourselves enough. So.
Well, we do. Over the years, we have. I think, but it's probably a redundant discussion. But still, you know, it's nice to know where we stand.
It is. It's good. How's the week that? Well, the 8 days that have just gone been treating you?
It's been busy and lots of stuff for, I guess, virtual conferences and things like that, recording interviews and talking to different people. And today there was the CIO magazine one that I kind of, well, done a recording for it a week or so ago, but that was today. So I hung around that a bit. So it's been a, you know, all that kind of thing recently. I've been sadly locked in my house and not doing those exciting going out and meeting people things I was doing just a couple of weeks ago. How about you?
Outdoors is like a distant memory. Yeah, just sort of cracking on with the work to be able to now try to cost justify a massive transformation program, you know, which is just a delight, quite frankly. Had a fascinating time this morning, though. Tortoise, the media thing, set up by James Harding and others a couple of years ago. They're doing this. Actually, it's a format that has really blossomed, I think, in lockdown. So they do these open news events called Think-ins, and since lockdown they've had to move them all online, but it just makes them much more accessible. And there was a fascinating one this morning which was entitled, I think, how do we get rid of white supremacy in the tech industry. And a group of people from mostly black background leading the discussions about challenges of ethnicity, of diversity, of things around artificial intelligence and inbuilt bias into data and algorithmic thinking and all this kind of stuff. It's a really, really interesting conversation. And one of the things that came out of it for me as an idea, especially because I'm doing a lot of procurement at the moment, the delights of, last week I knocked back a potential supplier because of the extreme bullshit on their website, where they, under their corporate values, which they had number one about diversity and how diversity gives us our strength, and this was on the page immediately under the picture of four white dudes who were the directors of the company. I thought, if you can't even see the crass nonsense that's going on there, I do not want to involve you in my organisation, thank you very much. Anyway, got me thinking at the session this morning. You know, things like ISO 27001, which you just use as this kind of one-way, quick way to be able to assure on something like information security. Is there an ISO standard for organisations to comply to be able to demonstrate that they have policies and process in place that means that they're not monoculture arsehole places? And if there isn't, there should be. And what a fantastic quick criteria it would be. And so that's maybe my new mission in life, is to think about how we can make diversity and inclusion a part of procurement processes, because that will start to push this as an agenda item on organisations in the tech industry in a way that talking about how it's ethically the right thing to do really doesn't, because they're psychopaths. So anyway, that was my thinking out this morning. It's a very good session.
Very good. Well, I know that IDC, we've got a sustainability practice which has that kind of thing in terms of, yes, how sustainable are you as a business? And we look at the, obviously, the tech companies, the big tech companies, but as part of that sustainability index, diversity is in there, right? Because it's part of that agenda. So yeah, I think that is something that people could do.
So anyway, this week we are delighted to be able to welcome not one, no, but two guests to the show. It's quite frankly, it's just an exercise in me making the editing harder. But I'm absolutely delighted to be joined both by Wendy Kendall and Tom Cheesewright. So I'm going to start, as is de rigueur these days, by who is top right on my screen. Wendy, hello, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Matt. Thanks for inviting me. I'm delighted to be part of your first four-person podcast, cutting new ground.
Yeah. I know, it's terrifying. We'll find out a bit more about you as we get into the meat of the bone. And the meat of the bones, that makes no sense. And then Tom, Tom Cheesewright, hello, how are you?
Good, thank you, Matt, thank you. Are you drinking WKD, by the way? It does look like you're drinking something blue at the other end.
No, it's water. Good God, I don't need energy drinks. Not at my age. So the reason for bringing everybody together tonight was out the back of a Twitter conversation that happened a few weeks ago. It was one of those very rare ones for me that actually went sort of vaguely... viral's too strong a term for it, but it got amplification, as they say. And there was one part of the discussion that emerged out of that. The theme of the tweet was basically just an observation that there's lots of people saying about how people need to work in physical space because, you know, what will happen for these poor new people coming into the workplace if they can't learn on the job? They can't pick up by osmosis what it is to work through being in an office. And the original tweet was just framing that as a question about, well, isn't it just about how people who are established in organisations need to change how they communicate with people who are new so that they make themselves more available and more transparent and more open? And it's not a problem. This is an opportunity to be exploited rather than a problem to be overcome. Anyway, there's lots of debate about it. What we're going to do on this week's show is just dig into that a bit more to think about what is it that organisations and people might need to think about if we're going to be a lot more remote, a lot less in the office, and still need to be able to get people to be able to be part of the organisations we're in. So that's the framing. Let's get on with it. So to start this off, let's just get a feel about where people's minds are at the moment with... What does it mean to learn the ropes in an organisation when that organisation is becoming increasingly remote, less office-based? Wendy, what's your take on this from the outset?
Yeah, so I think it's really interesting that you phrase it in terms of learning the ropes. And I remember on our Twitter conversation, this is where Tom and I had a bit of a discussion about it, because... learning is one thing. So you might think about skill and knowledge-based learning, learning how to do your job, which I should imagine as CIOs, CTOs, etc., you get really heavily involved in, right? Learning technologies and so on. But learning the ropes starts to touch into more human and social processes that are around socialization and start to lead to topics like culture and how we share values. So I like the question because it does tap into these other human aspects. Now, I have seen organizations that are much more distributed. Also, many, many years ago, my first job was, I was a military psychologist initially, and my first job was helping American and UK soldiers to train together in a distributed interactive simulation system. That was 25 years ago. And they were learning how to understand one another's military doctrine, which is very conceptual and very nebulous. So it wasn't a pure skill-based learning. So this can be done. And the question is, what do we need to learn about and implement in organizations to be successful at it?
Thank you, Wendy. Tom, your views on this theme of learning ropes?
So I come into this as a bit of a skeptic about not the possibility that we can shift these important bits of cultural and informal learning to remote ways of working. I think it's eminently possible. What I don't see yet is much evidence of many organizations who've cracked it. And, you know, I spend a lot of time inside big organizations, and actually some of the organizations we all think of as being really sophisticated at this sort of stuff. And I don't see much evidence inside even those that they've got the solution to this problem. What I see in organizations that are going to remote working is generally leveraging people with experience who've already embedded in that culture or have established the skills that they need and can then continue with some self-directed learning to improve themselves, but don't need the sort of rough edges knocking off that I did as a very arrogant 21-year-old coming on into the workplace. And I also see them actually, you know, even more cynically, actually ignoring the needs of the people who don't fit that mold and extracting from them what they need, but not doing the pastoral investment that they might do that might be considered sort of de rigueur if those people were in the office. And so for both those reasons, and for the simple human reason, and I completely appreciate Wendy's experience, which, you know, massively surpasses mine in trying to address these problems. I'm more coming at this from the sort of anecdotal experience of the fact that most people aren't anywhere near doing it. My concern comes from the fact that we are embodied, you know, creatures. Our experience is very, very, you know, our physical experience is very important beyond the stuff that can be extracted and piped through a screen and a pair of headphones and a microphone. And, you know, I think about, you know, so much of the subtle signals that I picked up on. And, you know, I wasn't in IT, I was worked in marketing, but the stuff I learned about how to handle a meeting, how to handle a phone call, time management, workload management, boss management, so much of that came from the consistent exposure to people around me doing it a hell of a lot better than I did, which I don't understand how you can replicate, or at least I don't see anybody replicating right.
So I get that for the idea of how we have worked, and that I put out a fairly sarcastic tweet earlier today talking about how essentially all of the learned behaviours that we have in the workplace are all completely learned in a completely fabricated environment, because none of it is some sort of genetic inheritance. We weren't wandering around the open plan offices of the Serengeti doing brainstorming sessions. You know, that's not our genetic inheritance. Everything is false. So whilst you might not have been able to learn, you might not be able to learn how to work in an office if you're not in an office. Is that the problem we face now, though? Because we're not working in offices anymore, or we're working in offices very differently. There's a whole bunch of new behaviours that maybe everybody needs to learn.
It's absolutely true. And I think not just new behaviours, but new systems, new technologies, new processes. You know, there's the individual element to it, and there's the more sort of structural element to it. But all of those things, as soon as you put that word remote into it, you're stripping away, you know, 3 million years of human experience as collaborative animals. So while it, you know, brainstorming sessions may not be embedded in our DNA just yet, there are analogs that go back an awfully long time that are very much part of our, you know, our collaborative experiences as animals.
And yet, the American Psychological Association recently have been keeping under review the progress in teletherapy. So let's take an example of where human interaction and being with and connecting with people for therapeutic purposes, you know, that's really kind of pushing the, let's say, the envelope a little bit in terms of how we come across the screen to people. So the APA has kept that under review because we've been delivering remote therapy to people since 1960 and, you know, it really goes back a long time, this history, whether that's by telephone or increasingly by internet. And it, just at the beginning of July, they had done a review of what had happened since the lockdowns had been occurring also across the US. And, you know, there's lots and lots of evidence now that teletherapy, for example, even in for quite extreme challenges for people, is actually effective. So something is going on in terms of that human process of connecting. And we do have a kind of basis for understanding how that happens, because I mean, I think the technology is important, you know, stable internet connection so that you get a continuity and a flow, good audio, good video, you know, all of those things which have an impact, technology that recedes out of the relationship. But we know, for example, that our nervous systems pick up a lot of signals that we don't even pick up consciously. And so, and nevertheless, it's true that psychologists are also skilled in picking those up. So I think we also have a kind of upskilling to do, but it's not that we, to your point, Matt, it's not that we are somehow especially limited by going into technology. Somehow there seems to be enough, at least, that's getting transmitted through that technology that can also allow even a therapeutic relationship.
But that feels very different to me. It feels narrow, directed, structured, that therapeutic conversation, much more so than the informal learning environment of the workplace. You know, it feels to me there's a gulf between those two examples, where, you know, there's no goal direction in so much of the learning in that environment. Like, I'm a big fan of online remote learning. I'm a huge fan. You know, I never get bored of telling people, although they get bored of hearing it. You know, I'm in the middle of building an EV. You know, where did the skills to do that come from? YouTube. Brilliant. Yeah, you know, I picked up so much stuff there. And, you know, last night I spent 2 hours on a seminar with a bunch of people who are all on the online course I'm on. And it was fantastic. You know, there was, you know, interaction and conversation, and it was very human and good humoured. But we were there with a specific goal. You know, we were there with you know, a bunch of set texts that we'd all read, we'd all discussed, and we all learned loads and, you know, arguably socialised and learned a bit about each other. But it would have been a completely different, and I would say much richer experience if we were there in the physical world.
In the book The Victorian Internet, which was written by Tom Standage about 20 so years ago, and he talks, the Victorian Internet is basically the telegraph, and he traces the history of the telegraph. And in the earliest days when the telegraph was manually operated, electrical telegraph, the semaphore and stuff before that, and the opening up of the world because you suddenly were able to be able to send messages across the Atlantic in a matter of seconds rather than days, which totally changed, you know, the impact of that in comparison to, you know, Facebook, quite frankly, in terms of quantum leap is massive, even though the bandwidth of it was much narrower. But he talks about these lovely stories about how the telegraph operators formed relationships with one another. So what you were talking about there, Tom, was about kind of structured learning, formal learning, output-based learning. The telegraph operators learned about each other, and there was chit-chat in between the messages that were going through. But they even got to the point where they could spot who was on the line through the patterns and the rhythm of zeros and ones, that we as humans can get down to being able to spot personality and person with just binary input. So, I think there's something about how we must also be able to adapt to the media in which we are operating.
Yeah, I think we absolutely can. I've no doubt that we can. I guess my question is, you know, one of the things I do a lot of local radio, right? And local radio is brilliant for connecting you to where the world is rather than where you think the world is. Like, you know, I spend half my time surrounded by technologists and futurists and people who are, you know, living a very sort of high-tech lifestyle. And then you go on local radio and realize you still have to explain what a blog is in 2020, right? And, you know, the reality for, you know, 99% of people in the workforce, that they are within a decade of doing that sort of adaptation, I just think isn't there. I'm not saying it's not possible. I just think it's not realistic for most. You know, the idea that we're going to have some sort of solution to that, or we could design and build one that's going to be applicable to most companies rather than just the internet giants during the period of lockdown, certainly, or even, you know, the next 2 years, feels deeply unrealistic to me.
Just to build on that, I think, right, so I've been listening to what everybody said, and I think there's so much value in all of these experiences. And I think if we think about that military aspect, about the fact that you've got, you're talking about British and American troops, and it's almost their ethos that they have to be able to understand each other's ethos. And that ethos wasn't taught. It wasn't taught in a classroom. It wasn't taught on a rifle range. It wasn't taught on a drill square. It was learned through imitation. And there's one of those Confucius sayings that I sometimes roll out in times of need, and it says, by three methods we may learn. The first is by reflection, which is the noblest. The second by imitation, which is the easiest. And the third by experience, which is the bitterest. And I normally use that when we've done something terribly wrong and we're kind of learning from the mistakes. But that kind of imitation one being the easiest, that really is, you know, if you think about the conversation we've had and the things that Tom's talking about, when we go into the workplace, you know, especially when we're young and we're trying to figure out how we fit, we're trying to be useful. We need to be useful. If we're not useful, we're not going to last very long. And in order to be useful, you have to get used to the pattern, the ways of working. You have to get used to how people interact with each other. And you do that through imitation. You do that through observing people. As much as you get the occasional, you know, a bit of guidance or a kind of metaphorical clip around the ear or whatever it might be, that's how you do it. And I understand what you're saying, Matt. There's no hardwired need for that in the human condition, but that just is where we are. So the question is, as I think, you know, I hear what Tom's saying. If you suddenly say, okay, we're now all remote, and here's this new person joining the team, we're going to have to make an effort, a bit like the example of the therapy. That is about investment. That's about a focus on that outcome. And when you're in a sort of therapy session, I am assuming it's a one-to-one thing, and you know that's all those two people are going to be talking about, which is so very rarely the case in work. That's just not often the way it happens. So I think it's a real challenge. I think there's a lot to be picked out of how people learn what they have to learn and how you replace that in a remote way, because it's just not going to be there. We're going to forget about it, and then we're going to realize it that we missed it.
What I would say though is that so we were talking earlier about moving into cyber world with your organization, yeah, so relocating to a new country in a sense, which is this cyber world. And I'm not entirely convinced that the people who are going to have the biggest cultural leap to make there are the youngest ones in the organization. I think they're the, you know, in my experience, the people who are challenged moving that across. I mean, maybe the challenge is just different in different parts of the organization, but it is a rapid, because of external forces at the moment, it is a rapid transformation and a rapid transition and very disruptive. So there are things that we know we should be building into people's experience of a company that will facilitate them doing that. So, you know, working to support people's, so people are in a threat state, yeah, more or less feeling more of a threat state at the moment. And we know that causes people to go into patterns of protection rather than patterns of connection. So whatever we can do in terms of providing consistency, sense of safety. I know you had a podcast earlier on psychological safety. You know, whatever we can do to support that, and also helping individuals themselves, whether that be through organizational, you know, employee assistance programs or whatever it is, and just supporting people so they're not automatically in that threat state on an ongoing basis, will itself, because it's how we're built, make it easier for people to connect with one another, and therefore easier to share and learn and be open and so on. You know, there's quite an easy model of well-being called PERMA. It was quite well researched in the early 2000s, and that stands for positive emotions. Feeling positive emotions opens up our connection, engagement, positive relationships. So they are. Motivation and achievement. So build those five things in, and you're giving yourself much more of a much more likelihood that this natural vicarious learning and socialization and connecting and so on will happen more spontaneously anyway.
I'd say that connects really closely to something Chris was saying, because one of the things that occurred to me was if you are devoting time to those conversations and making sure that you're sort of programming those conversations to build that sort of perma mindset, particularly with a new employee, one of the things that FieldTech is going to do is actually consume a lot more time. And so, you know, as a bad analogy, but the closest one I've got to hand, I've got a talk coming up. I was meant to be doing it face to face. I'm now doing it remotely. They've asked me to pre-record it. As soon as you pre-record something, you then want to edit it. And so to do this thing remotely, rather than just doing it down the line and sort of off the cuff, I've ended up spending an entire day recording what would normally be a half hour talk, you know, editing it, remastering the sound because it had all sorts of, you know, because I'd recorded it in my basement. Yeah, and so the amount of investment just to replicate that face-to-face experience, even though we think of the online remote world as being super efficient, it's actually been, you know, 8 times as much. And it feels like if we're going to have to program conversations to recreate something that was happening in a sort of abstract, just osmosis way, I think one of the words we used before, that feels like that's going to be, I'm not saying we should, I think we have to, and I think we will, but it also feels like an enormous time suck. I'm now more skeptical about all these numbers about automation knocking out jobs, because we're just going to have loads of work therapists, basically.
I just like to point out, as any regular listener to the show will tell you, by recording something, it doesn't immediately bring in some sort of urge to be able to edit it for an entire day. I'm interested coming back to this point, though, of entering into cyber world, though, because, Wendy, part of what you do large part from the sounds of it about what you do is about helping people to be able to think about when they relocate to different countries, and presumably relatively senior people when they're relocating in management and leadership roles, I assume in you know, big global multinational corporates. If you were to give advice to a leader who was moving from a job working in the UK to a job working in cyber world, so I guess independently of any of the sort of local cultural things that would be involved with that, what are the sorts of things for them to be able to engage in their new environment with their new colleagues, with their new workforce? How do you go about helping people with that?
When I work with people, one of the challenges when they relocate to that radically changed environment is often that they have quite fixed ideas about how to be successful. And if they can't do that, it feels like they're losing part of themselves. They can't be themselves anymore. And then they go into that kind of threat state. So we end up working, first of all, with that threat state to support them out of that. That's helping them to develop, you know, an awareness of it, giving them tactics around how to deal with that, knowing what their triggers are, and just kind of building in that internal emotional flexibility almost. And then helping them become aware of where they're getting fixed in terms of their style and themselves become. So it's really about developing their awareness of all the different things they are and all the different possibilities they have in terms of how they show up in front of people, and helping them just be more flexible across a range of scenarios. So it's working a lot on that psychological and emotional flexibility and having a range of styles and a range of ways in which they influence people. And then you've got a kind of structure, which is, you know, let's think about how you support the team. And in fact, I'm saying this as though it's done, because I've actually got people where they should have been moving to America, for example, and they can't get in the country, and they're not going to be getting in the country anytime soon. So they're literally leading this new team and becoming the leader of this new team from thousands of miles away and with no end in sight to that proposition. So beyond the flexibility, what else are we doing? Looking at how they collaborate and coach with people. So put effort and time and space into building collaboration and coaching people. Look at this kind of water cooler contact, showing that they care, showing that they want to connect with people and they're open with them. And then you're looking at some of the higher impact interactions. So get your message out there, you know, influence, impact, direct, and so on. And then harness things like internal podcasts, internal video channels, Slack channels, and so on to actually develop evergreen content, which can go out there and do a job for them. So there's a kind of pyramid that we created over the last 6 months or so as I've been working with people, and we've been kind of literally brainstorming it together and saying, this is how I think it could work. And yeah, that's what we've been doing.
I guess the other bit for that, how often do you or have you worked with people who are having to go into a place where the main language isn't their language? Is that something that you've seen?
Typically for these big companies, everyone is speaking English or they're speaking French, for example. Okay. So there will be a common language.
Because I'm just wondering whether there's maybe stretching a metaphor a bit, but that for an established person going to work in cyber world now, partly it's about then, well, the way I've usually got them to do stuff isn't working now because I can't just stand over their desk until they eventually do it. So that kind of, you know, poor management style. But then also and then the language I'm using doesn't seem to be landing with them in the way that I would expect it to, because...
Oh, that happens even if you speak English.
Okay.
So if, you know, even if you're an English speaker and you're speaking English with people in different parts of the world, literally things don't translate.
Yeah, I can testify to that.
So anyone out there experiencing that, that's normal.
Yeah, try doing jokes at an English language conference in France or Germany or Spain or, yeah.
Yeah.
They get the language, the humour doesn't land. Maybe it's just my jokes.
The idioms are tough as well. I've got endless idioms that I will come out with. But then because I work quite a lot with people from in different countries, whether it's my colleagues or clients, and I really have to dial back on these because they, you know, well, how should they know what, you know, these daft English aphorisms mean? They don't and shouldn't.
Yeah, there's something I've started recently. I think I might have mentioned it on the show last week, but actually. If I'm about to use an idiom in work, well, I've got quite a diverse team that's working with me at the moment. A, to be able to know that I know what it means if I'm going to continue to use it so that I can explain it if they need it explaining. But then also to make sure that I'm not using something that actually, when you look into it, is deeply offensive, because there's a stack of those. And we just kind of use them on it, which is, so... There's been a sort of boundaries here of what is formal learning and informal learning. I wonder whether as well part of the issue that we face going forward is that we haven't really understood what is really going on in the office anyway. And the stuff that is superficially there. So, for example, if you take meetings, I'm increasingly coming to the view that most meetings, the actual meeting itself isn't very valuable, but it's the stuff that sat around it, the side conversations, the sense of being able to build trust or otherwise in colleagues, that the things that were surrounding it were where the value were. And then when you stick that sort of meeting into Zoom, you lose most of the valuable bits. You're ending up with this hollow core of meaninglessness. What are the things that we didn't know that we needed in offices that we need to now find out how to do differently?
One of them, to come back to Chris's point, you know, this style of management of just standing over someone until it gets done, that is still like 90% of management. Like, you know, the number of people who are actually doing proper, you know, task assignment, you know, agreeing a sort of, you know, a hypothesis about how something's going to get done, you know, measuring it properly and then trusting the person to deliver it without your oversight is still just a fraction of most workplaces. Like the stuff that people, particularly I run to courses sometimes, and the things that people report to me on those courses, and this is MDs telling me about stuff that's still going on in their business, is just horrifying. Well, we have such a long way to go to get even to a style of working that works in that environment. But that's what really scares me. I think you're right. I think we have very little understanding of what actually goes on in the office. I think most businesses are held together by good people spinning lots of plates and overcoming a complete failure of process.
And Excel.
and Excel. Lots and lots of interlinked Excel spreadsheets.
But they're also trying to get on, right? They're trying to get the next job or to be, you know, to get a pay rise or whatever, right? So whatever they're doing, they want somebody to notice it. If they've got anything about them, they're trying to do something which is noticed by somebody. So they go, Smithers is doing a good job. Let's give him the job of such and such. And that's not so, you know, it's very different when you're working remotely. It's a different level of sort of managing upwards that needs to happen. And let's face it, the politics of an organisation doesn't go away just because everybody's working remotely, but it gets a whole bunch more, I guess, it's harder to see and it's harder to manage because you're not in amongst it. Lots of examples I've got of that. I'm not going to share them.
I mean, let me give you a quick hypothetical example. You know, you're a junior member of staff. You're brilliant, you're productive, but you are stuck under a line manager who's still trying to manage in the old office fashion rather than, you know, than the way we should be. And you've got somebody who joined at exact same time as you, same qualifications, same capability, but is under a line manager who gets it, who trusts you to go and deliver, assign stuff properly. How are you going to build the political relationships you need to that go beyond your line manager in order to overcome that hurdle and demonstrate your value? It's going to be really challenging.
Do we think, though, within that context, what will happen is we'll just see increasing staff turnover?
No, we'll just see people using LinkedIn loads.
And Wendy, for you, if there were areas of the value of office that have not really been appreciated, that we're now going to know when they're no longer there, are there things that you think we need to find alternatives for?
I'm thinking about, so there was an article that struck me the other day on LinkedIn or somewhere, I can't remember. I commented on both LinkedIn and Twitter about it, which was talking about how the commute was serving a function of helping people to de-stress at the end of the day. And people were bemoaning the loss of the commute. And I thought that was quite interesting, because essentially what was happening in the workplace was disturbing people to the point where they needed to de-stress on the way home. And yet we were mourning the loss of the de-stressor. And so it's like, well, that's just implying that whatever is burning us out in the workplace physically is still burning us out in the remote workplace. So what is that? So I got really curious about that. Now, how you would find that out, you know, for me as you know, behavioral scientist, thinking about going into organizations and doing research and how would that work, you know, how would organizations find out what are those burnout factors and so on that are in the remote workplace as well as maybe, or maybe different to the centralized workplace. I don't know. But I think we do have an opportunity to examine what would a really healthy workplace look like. That is, there's a guy who's a bit of a giant in psychology. Some of you may have heard of him, a guy called Carl Rogers, and he was the father of counseling psychology. And I read an essay of his many years ago, and it really stuck with me. And it said, there's no reason why work cannot be a therapeutic environment. There's no reason why work cannot help people. And it would be awesome to get towards that. And there are pockets of that. There are places where people go to work where they end up feeling better about themselves and better about the world and really achievement and satisfied. So let's find that and start doing more of that in the even in the remote workplace.
Well, that was great fun. I hope you enjoyed it. Wendy, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Tom, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris, the week ahead, how's it looking?
Well, pretty much like last week, in as much as lots of virtual events and doing that kind of thing. And I'm looking forward to getting through September and October. It's pretty busy, and it's going to be good fun. But I'll be glad when all of these things that are in the diary and are kind of hard scheduled. I'm not very good with things that definitely have to happen on a certain day. I get quite worried about those things. So, it's good. What about you?
I've got no idea, to be honest. There's some stuff. Oh no, we've got the end of our first big procurement exercise. So we've been using government purchasing frameworks to do something blind assessment of bidders, which I've never done before. And you kind of, I spent my first wave going, oh my God, I'm gonna select Accenture, aren't I? And thankfully I didn't, because they hadn't bid. This was awesome. So that all comes to an end on Monday, I think it is. So that'll be that bit. And then we've got a big piece of work around looking at our service proposition to our customers, and then starting to look at customer journeys around that, which is like really changing how we're thinking about how we deliver services to our customers, which is very exciting, and starting to get some flesh on those bones as well. So that's great. We have a fantastic show this week. We will have another fantastic show next week. We will be joined again by Steve Chapman, and he's going to be talking with us about what he has learned from doing 100 podcasts consisting of 2 minutes of silence, which, if you've listened to this show week in, week out, I bet you must have wished this one had been like sometimes as well. But there we go. So thanks again to Tom and Wendy. Thank you for listening. And we will be back with you with Steve Chapman next week.
Thank you for listening to WB40. You can find us on all good podcasting platforms.